Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. My notes tell me that we have students from Maranatha Baptist Academy. If that's the case, would you please stand? Oh, very nice. A good group. Thank you. You may be seated.
How do you pronounce the name?
Maranatha. Maranatha. So I had the accent on the wrong syllable. It happens. Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us. If you can remain after the second argument, then Justice Rebecca Bradley will come down and chat with you a little bit about cases and how they get to the Supreme Court and perhaps answer some questions for you. She won't talk to you about, obviously, the substance of this case, but you have had an opportunity to learn a little bit about it. Okay, so with that taken care of, we'll call our first case of the morning, Waukesha County versus SLL. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant State Public Defender Colleen Ball, appearing on behalf of the petitioner.
I'm not hearing you.
All right. Can you hear me now?
Better, yes.
All right.
Yes,
Assistant State Public Defender Colleen Ball, appearing on behalf of the petitioner, SLL. This appeal really boils down to questions of law about personal jurisdiction and the possibility of an involuntary default commitment. And I think there is a simple rule that would resolve all of the issues for review, and the rule is this. If a county fails to serve a petition for commitment on the subject of the petition, then the circuit court must dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction.
Then what?
Then the circuit court must dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. So failure of service means no personal jurisdiction.
Well, counsel, you already had, though, she was already subject to the personal jurisdiction of the court, and the hearing was held during the 6 months of the initial commitment. So I don't know. I have a different concern about default judgment than I do about personal jurisdiction, but I don't see how you can say there was a lack of personal jurisdiction. Her lawyer was served.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, I think if I could make sort of fundamental points at the outset of the argument, it would deal with that very concern, and I think all of the rest of the solution to the rest of the issues will make sense.
Well, it's a very broad brush you want to paint with, but go ahead.
Thank you very much. The first point I would like to make is that Chapter 51 is a medical statute. It's not a criminal statute. It's not a punitive statute. And the county's interest under Chapter 51 is to treat a person who is so medically ill that they can't take care of themselves, they can't make good decisions. So that's the first point. It's not to penalize people. The second point that I'd like to make is that an original commitment and a recommitment are two distinct proceedings. There's a relationship between them that we'll get to in a second, but each proceeding is distinct, and that's an important point. These proceedings are begun with a petition, a filing, and a service, if you will. And the service is prescribed by statute. That's 5122B. And once it's accomplished, the individual who is the subject of the commitment is notified of a whole panoply of constitutional rights, which they may exercise, including trial, where, as a matter of fact, there must be a hearing. There must be a trial. And at that trial, the county bears the burden of proving three things at the original: mentally ill, proper subject for treatment, and dangerous. Now, let's suppose that the county thinks we need a recommitment. It has to initiate a whole new proceeding.
Why do they need to initiate a whole new proceeding?
Well, they're required to meet a whole new standard, and it's a different standard. It's not the same standard.
The standard's the same, except dangerousness is easier to prove.
I would argue that makes it a different standard, Your Honor.
So let's say there's a change in that element of what they're supposed to prove. Why does that mean it's a new proceeding rather than just something new substantively that you have to prove?
Well, Your Honor, if it isn't a new proceeding, then why are we bothering, for example, with a trial? That's required. That's required under the statutes that you get all of the same rights at the second proceeding.
Right. Well, I mean, I think perhaps the reason that the new trial is required is because you're trying to extend a limited commitment, right? So you have the original commitment hearing. The person becomes subject to the jurisdiction of the court because, by virtue of the commitment order. And then within that 6 months, if the county wants to continue that commitment, they need to show that they have reason to do that. But it is a continuation, right? I mean, the statutes speak in terms of a petition for extension of the commitment.
Actually, Your Honor, if you search the statute, you're going to find in one place it says extension, and in other place it uses the term recommitment, which I actually think is a more accurate description of what's going on here. It is true, if there were a gap in between the two, like let's say there was a gap of 3 months, you'd have to have two original commitments. So if the county follows the statute and within the period of the original commitment it initiates a recommitment proceeding, then you're right, you're essentially extending the original commitment for another year. But it's a whole new proceeding in the sense that the county and the circuit court have to jump through all the same hoops in the sense of having a hearing, being held to a burden of proof, allowing evidence, et cetera. And, very importantly, at the recommitment proceeding, the county can't just rely on the evidence that it presented at the first commitment. There has to be fresh evidence in order to extend the commitment.
Before we get into that issue, I want to stick with the jurisdictional issue.
I haven't even gotten to jurisdiction.
Okay. And I want you to get into it, but the question that I have for you is when I look at 5120 sub G3, that's where it talks about upon application for extension mm-hmm. of a commitment. And it goes on to say the court shall proceed under subs 10 through 13. Subsection 10 mm-hmm. is hearings. Subsection 11 is jury trial. I don't think that's an issue here in this case. And sub 12 is open hearings. But subsection 10A provides within a reasonable time prior to the final hearing, the petitioner's counsel shall notify the subject individual and his or her counsel of the time and place of final hearing, and then it goes on to have other provisions for how the hearing shall be conducted. But we have a specific direction in there that subs 10 through 13 govern what is to happen under an application for an extension. So I think procedurally that suggests to me that we're to treat that proceeding and the procedural requirements a bit differently than with the initiation of commitment proceedings under a petition for examination, because we don't have a petition for examination here, right?
We do, actually. And if you look at the mandatory circuit court form for a petition for recommitment, it is a petition for recommitment for for examination.
The form that I pulled up from the forms online is evaluation, recommendation, and petition for recommitment.
Exactly. Yes, same right. form. Right. And I want to get to your point, Your Honor, under I believe it was G3, and the section that you pointed out, upon application for extension of commitment, then you follow 10 to 13. Well, the critical clause there is upon application for extension of commitment. That means there had to have been an application for the extension of commitment. I interpret that to mean a petition for the extension of commitment, the very form that you just held up. If that's filed, then the court proceeds under 10 through 13. This statute section isn't saying skip the petition, just proceed under 10 through 13. And I think the part of the statute that backs me up on that, Your Honor, would actually be 5120, if I can get to it quickly, 5122B. That's the one that is titled Notice and Hearing, and it's the one that describes service of process, basically, in this case. I know it's in here this moment.
But doesn't that section just apply to the initial petition for examination to initiate a Chapter 51? We already have a Chapter 51 proceeding underway here.
No, I would disagree with you on that point for this reason. First of all, if you look at 5120A, B, and C, 5120 clearly applies to recommitments because both A and C, for example, are specifically mentioning AM, which is the recommitment statute. B, which is the service portion of it, doesn't pull out AM because it doesn't need to. That clearly, it doesn't, under A, you have to say, look, you know, here we are giving a notice of a hearing. The county must give notice that the subject of the commitment meets either the standard under A, which is the original, or AM, which is the recommitment. B, which we're now at for the service of process, applies to both of them, and then you get to C, what happens in another event. It'll be one thing if it's A, it'll be a different thing if it's AM. So I think a close scrutiny of 5120-2B shows that it applies to both, and as a practical matter, as a constitutional matter, it must apply to both for this reason. When a person is committed under an original commitment, they aren't necessarily locked in a hospital for 6 months. They, as quickly as they can be, they must be moved to the least restrictive environment. And that can be anywhere. It could stay in a hospital, but it could be a group home, it could be assisted living, or remarkably, as occurred in this place, the county thought, geez, it's a good idea to take a homeless person and say, let's put her 30 miles away in a motel, right? Where I'm not sure how they were supposed to monitor in that situation. But my point is, once you're under an original commitment and you're allowed to be transferred into the community, you there. So you need notice that there is a recommitment proceeding. And if you don't have that notice, and the notice is what then gives the court subject matter jurisdiction. And I guess another point I'd like to make here is it isn't unusual that a person could be committed, for example, to Waukesha, but for some reason they're living in a different county. They need to have notice of the recommitment proceeding. Otherwise, they can't appear and defend their rights. And that's really what... That's really what personal jurisdiction is all about.
Didn't her lawyer appear?
Her lawyer did, and Your
right,
Honor.
So he was served. I want you to focus on the default judgment. I see jurisdiction a little bit differently than you do, but I really have concerns about entering a default judgment without personal service. And if you have the hearing and everyone shows up and so forth, but the subject doesn't show up. Do you think that the judge should have issued KPS for her to bring her in and serve her that way? Or
no.
What do you think should have happened?
Absolutely not. I don't think there can ever be a default involuntary commitment under Chapter 51, and it's for two reasons.
Okay.
One, if she wasn't served, the court can't do it because she didn't have notice of the hearing, and to my mind, the court did not have personal jurisdiction to enter the default judgment. But let's pretend she was served. Let's pretend that we have some hypothetical situation where we've got a person who disappeared or whatever. They served her, and she didn't show up for her recommitment hearing. At that point, the reason you can't have a default judgment is that 5120.10 sub D comes into play. And that statute says, and I'm quoting, In the event that the subject individual is not detained and fails to appear for the final hearing, the court may issue an order for the subject individual's detention and shall hold a final commitment hearing within 7 days from the time of detention.
Well, that went to my question. That was my question to you, because I have concerns about the default judgment. Don't have your concerns about personal jurisdiction. But the default judgment does trouble me, and my question to you was, well, then shouldn't, when she didn't show up, shouldn't the court have just issued an order for her detention? Because she's a person that it's not like you or me, where you can find us and serve us. She's kind of on the move, and, you know, the statutes are there to try to help her, and she's got a chronic condition, so she's not going to get away without needing help. It's just going to be a matter of when she's going to receive it again.
So I would have two responses to 20 applying 51-2010D in this context. My first, as you know, is there was no personal jurisdiction, so the court couldn't proceed. There's also no notice. She had no notice that she was supposed to be here, so the court couldn't enter it.
I get that, but my question is, what should the court have done? Because we didn't take this case to decide your client's issues. We took the case to try to give direction to other folks that may have a similar problem.
Right. So in this particular situation, when the original commitment expired and the county did not know where she was, the court couldn't enter this 51-2010D
order. Okay, but the original commitment had not expired at the time they were all in court together, okay, in this case. And that may be the case when judges are watching the timeline and they try to have a hearing within the time of the original commitment. So if we're in that framework, mm-hmm. then the judge should have issued an order to pick her up and bring her in. Is that correct?
If it has jurisdiction, yes. But, Your Honor, I just want to point something out. This is kind of a reality check. What good does that detention order do? Nobody knows where she is, and the county's sole purpose is to treat her.
Well, I think the law enforcement officer would have to go on the street and ask around like they do when they pick up other folks that don't have a known address but are fluid in the community. You can only do what you can do, right?
Right.
You can't do magic, so.
Right. So in this, if I'm understanding the court's concern, it's like, well, what do we do when somebody violates a condition and then they don't keep you up to date at the address? And here's how I think that plays out. It was what I was trying to get to. So while I personally think these two types of proceedings are separate, they are related. So when you get to the recommitment hearing, at that point, you're going to have doctors preparing reports, and they're going to look at the person's treatment history. And part of this person's treatment history was the original commitment where she eloped, right? She left her commitment, apparently. And they're going to factor that in. So when they have to make a decision now, they've found her in the future at some point, and there's a commitment proceeding, they have to factor that in and say, well, this person's had prior commitments. We see this from her record. We see that she's a flight risk. They figure, well, okay, now we have to consider that when we're contemplating what is the least restrictive environment for this individual in the commitment proceeding that we have before us now.
Okay, but if the judge issued an order the day they were all together in this case and similar cases where they were still within the time frame of the original commitment and then brought her in, at that point in time, can't they go forward?
At that point in time, they could, if she had notice. If she had notice.
If they're bringing her in, she's going to get notice.
No, I meant if she had noticed that she was supposed to be at the hearing in the first place. If she didn't have notice, how was she supposed
to? You're giving me an impossible conundrum. The legislature didn't write anything that difficult.
No, the legislature wrote 51-2022B, which is a notice provision for these commitment proceedings. I mean, that's my position, Your Honor, that it would be impossible.
Counsel, could I take you a step back to this idea that these are separate proceedings?
Okay.
So I'm looking at in, I'll give you a couple seconds to process this because I know this case was not cited in either party's briefs. Soraki versus Clark County Circuit Court, 163 West 2nd, 152. It's one of our cases from 1991. And that dealt with a 5120 proceeding. And the question was whether in the recommitment the defendant had the right to substitute on a judge. And we said, no, that came too late. And here's why we said that. We said this description of the purpose of the recommitment hearing and the evidence to be presented support the respondent's argument that at the recommitment hearing, the circuit court continues to receive evidence in the same case. We are persuaded that the legislature intended an individual's recommitment hearing to be, in the context of a request for substitution, a continuation of the original commitment proceeding and previous recommitment hearings. Why does that not answer the question on whether these are separate proceedings?
Your Honor, it all comes back down to notice. I did not hear the court say that in Soraki it said the notice given at the original commitment is sufficient for the recommitment.
Right. So I kind of want to go in a stepwise fashion here. Oftentimes the things we do build upon each other. So your position, I think, is dependent on the proposition that the original commitment and the extension are different proceedings.
Well, right. There has to be notice for both of them. Why don't maybe we can solve it by putting it that way?
And I don't think there's, frankly, I don't think there's any dispute that there needs to be notice for both of them. The question is, what is the nature of the notice required for the extension or the recommitment? Right?
That is definitely the question.
So the way that you framed this is the notice is required, is the same kind of notice required to obtain personal jurisdiction originally, right?
Yes.
But according to Soraki, that tells us there's continuing personal jurisdiction. This is the same proceeding. This is just another mark, another event in a singular case. And we don't require, and I don't think we've ever required, the same kind of notice for each event in a proceeding that was necessary to obtain personal jurisdiction in the beginning, right?
Your Honor, I would disagree there. I think what happens as a practical matter in these recommitment proceedings is that the subjects of them are personally served. Sometimes they're in institutions and there's like a prison set or, you know, WRC. Or they, as I said, they can be out in the community or a variety of different places, and they are personally served.
Yeah. So before we get to the practical, I want to deal with the theoretical, right? So we can figure out what are the principles that we're supposed to be applying to the facts of this case and other cases going forward. So generally speaking, when the court obtains personal jurisdiction over an individual, there are very formal requirements, personal service, and all of that, and there's some substitution opportunities for that. However, once that is obtained, we don't require that kind of notice for every event that occurs in that proceeding, right? As a general...
That is correct.
So then the question is, if Soraki is right, that a recommitment is simply a continuation of the original commitment hearing, then the question is, do we need to go back to that original form of notice to get personal jurisdiction over the defendant initially, right?
Right.
Okay. And so what I'm wondering is why in a Chapter 51 proceeding this would be different from all other proceedings in which we don't repeat that same initial formality with respect to notice requirements. Why should we do that here?
And the reason we should do that here is if we do not require personal service at the recommitment stage, then you can have recommitment after recommitment after recommitment without notice. The person won't know that it's even happening. That's why there has to be personal service.
Are you premising this on not just the statute, but on case law with respect to mentally ill individuals?
I mean, or are you just looking at the statute when you say that?
Well, I'm relying on the statute. There isn't a prior case that has addressed the whole question of what is personal service in the context of a Chapter 50.
Right, but in terms of mentally ill and kind of the law surrounding rights, due process rights, but you're really focusing on the statute.
I'm focusing on the statute, but it also, Your Honor, it stands to reason. We're talking about people who have been declared so ill that they can't make good decisions. In this instance, the person is so ill, she's homeless and transient, and so she needs to be directly informed. And mailing wouldn't be good enough either. You don't know who it is that's receiving the mail at the other end. Are they giving it to this person? Can they understand it? You know.
So taking you back to Justice Rogan-Sack's question, do you see a way in your argument, if the court didn't go along with the notice aspect requiring personal service, to still find that default judgment is not appropriate? Do you find any way for the court to do that? I think that's what Justice Rogan-Sack's struggle was. I do find the default judgment piece of it the most troubling piece.
Well, I mean, part of the reason you can't have a default judgment from my end is it doesn't do any good. You can't treat the person if you don't know where they are. But you can never have a default judgment without notice. I mean, how is there any – they weren't notified of their right to show up, so how do you get there? I guess that's what I would have to say. And under the provision that Chapter 51 has provided, the provision the court is to act under, 51-2010-D, the case of Walworth versus Spalding or Spalding versus Walworth says, look, when a court says this is what we have to do when someone fails to show for a hearing, when the legislature says that, the legislature has acted there, and that's the procedure that you have to follow. You don't get to legislate from the bench and develop a whole new provision, which in this case would be legislating from the bench to create a default judgment type of statute. So,
and not just deferring to civil statutes in general, because that's the argument on the other side,
right,
is that you look just to general civil law and that this is not provided for in 51, so we turn to general civil law where you can default people.
It is provided for in 51. That's my argument. I mean, the provision under 51 says, unless otherwise provided, and my argument is that 51-2010-D is providing otherwise, and it's giving the court exactly two options in the event someone fails to show. One option is you go pick them up and you hold a hearing within 7 days, and the other option is you can choose to let it go, uses the word may. I see my time is up.
May it please the court, my name is Rob Miller. I'm an assistant corporation counsel in Waukesha County, and I handle the Chapter 51 matters for the Waukesha County Corporation Counsel's Office. I represent the public of Waukesha County in this case. And I want to start by addressing something that Justice Rogan-Sack said in a question to Attorney Ball. And the comment that Justice Rogan-Sack made was, statutes are there to help her, in talking about how we treat mentally ill people who are in our communities. And that's exactly right. What Chapter 51 is supposed to do is help individuals who either can't or won't, because of their illness, help themselves. And Justice Kelly talked about the punitive nature, or the non-punitive nature, I think, of Chapter 51. He's right, too. Because Chapter 51 is not a punishment statute. Chapter 51 is an assistance statute. And the first point I want to make to the court is that every mentally ill person has a right to mental health treatment, even when they don't want it, when they don't think they need it, and even when, through no fault of their own, they make substantial attempts to avoid it or can't otherwise avail themselves of it. And in fact, for that group of vulnerable people, that subset, it's more important.
What's the point of extending a commitment or attempting to extend a commitment over somebody who has essentially disappeared?
The point of that, Your Honor, is to continue that jurisdiction so that you can attempt to continue to treat the patient.
Why do you need to do that, though? You could just bring a new petition. If there are, you can always bring a new petition.
If you have new dangerousness.
No, you don't. Well, you don't necessarily need new dangerousness.
I would respectfully disagree, Justice Dowd. I think you do, because once the initial order of commitment expires or is terminated or is just otherwise gone, you need new dangerousness then. You can't file an extension in an expired case. And so you can't use that extension standard of dangerousness, the standard that says if treatment is withdrawn from you, you'll again become a proper subject for commitment. You no longer have that option.
You have to show recent acts, right?
Is that you have to show some new dangerousness.
Well, right. And okay, then let's take that argument even farther. If there's no recent acts, do you really need to be continuing to treat them? I mean, this is all for their good and for... They're good if they're not bothering anybody, even if they're homeless and not taking their medication. Why should the county care?
Well, in this case, initially what occurred was that in August of 2016, SLL attempted to physically attack another person and was committed based on that dangerousness. We're not that far removed from that when we get to the point of the time that we're seeking extension. And so we get from the commitment order is entered, treatment is mandated, the county department is then obligated, and it is their duty to treat this person in whatever manner they believe is the least restrictive, consistent with the patient's needs. And so that starts, and the last time we know that SLL received treatment was November 2nd, when she appeared to get a long-acting injectable shot that was part of her treatment.
Figure out the practical application of what you're asking for. So the person fails to show, let's say these facts, okay? And you're saying that then in order for recommitment for a year can be entered. And then at the end of the year, now let's say this person goes to Nevada, I'm now adding to the facts, you know, if the person is homeless and isn't back in Wisconsin for another 10 years or 15 years, is it your position that Waukesha County then is going to be filing a petition for recommitment every year, or let's say the person doesn't ever come back to the state of Wisconsin, when does Waukesha County stop filing their petitions for recommitment? Ever?
Yeah, Justice Bradley, the fact of the matter is that in the current case, Waukesha County ultimately determined that...
And you dismissed it.
We did. And the reason for that was, and I would note that that was about 7 months after the extension order was entered in February of 2017, and then I think it was August of 2017 the dismissal order was entered. And so what the statute requires is that the county treat the patient. And so the county has to weigh their obligation to treat the patient with their ability to do so. And so that's an ongoing process of evaluation that happens in real time,
time. When I read that in your dismissal, I took that. Were you the attorney, I'm sorry, at the hearing? Because, of course, you started out saying, hey, I don't think you can do this, Judge. There's no personal jurisdiction here. You started out saying that, but then got swept up and changed your mind. How's that? It seems to me that what you're going to be doing... And the reason I thought you dismissed it is because you thought maybe there was a little discomfort with the way that this was playing out and the effects of this case if it were on appeal. That's what I read into it, rather than all of a sudden Waukesha County saying, we're going to weigh our resources here and we're going to dismiss it.
Well, I would say a couple of things. First of all, the process of trying to determine whether someone can be treated, as I said, is an ongoing one. And so as the passage of time continued and we continued to not be able to locate SLL, the determination was made. I will tell you, Justice Bradley, that determination was not made based on the appeal, because that happens in other cases. And there are also times...
The strength of your position may be taken into effect, maybe not. I mean, there was great consternation between you and at the time of the hearing, let me get this fairly characterized. There was concern, I wouldn't say great consternation, there was concern about being able to go forward. There was concern about the lack of service. There was concern about the propriety of issuing a capias, even as opposed to an order for detention. There was treading carefully initially as to how to proceed.
I think that's fair, but I would say this, a couple of things to respond to that. The first is that the concern that I had was not that of personal jurisdiction. I wasn't concerned that we had jurisdiction, and in fact, the opposing counsel not only didn't object to personal jurisdiction, he conceded it. Within the transcript, he indicates that the jurisdiction attaches. What he said was, well, if the order's for 6 months, then you have personal jurisdiction for 6 months. I'm quoting him pretty close to exactly.
That's right.
And so the fact of the matter is, and I agree that personal jurisdiction attaches at the time of the original order, and it continues so long as that order or any extension to that order is in place. So
it continues beyond the initial 6 months.
So long as there's another order entered within that period of time.
Counsel, but the order here... Will you finish?
Finished enough. I'll
okay. I'm concerned about the default judgment. And the order of continuation that you eventually dismissed was based on a default judgment. And I don't really see how you can do that, frankly. And I don't understand why the court just didn't issue an order to pick her up. I know you might have trouble finding her. That's all of that's true. But you can only do what you can do, right? And was there some reason why you didn't get the court to do that? And could you not find her? I mean, was that tried?
Well, in terms of having her at the hearing?
Well,
I'm not understanding the justice's question. I'm sorry.
Okay. The hearing, she didn't have notice of the hearing. I think everybody agrees with that. My concern is the default judgment, and I have a problem with issuing a default judgment when there's no notice to the person that's held in default. So I guess my concern is, why wasn't there a request, or maybe there was and I missed it, for the judge to issue an order to pick her up, bring her in, and have a hearing within 7 to 10 days, whatever the statute provides?
Well, frankly, I made that request.
And the judge...
And the fact that I made that request, and I did, I mean, the transcript is clear. The first thing I said to the court was, issue a capias, and we'll hold the hearing within 7 days of her detention. There's a couple of issues with that that I think are important.
That's what I would like to know about.
Thank you. And the first is that just because I didn't ask for default judgment doesn't mean you can't use it or doesn't mean it wasn't appropriate in this case. I concede that I didn't make the request for default judgment. That was essentially a suggestion of the court. However, the problem with the statute and the problem with opposing counsel and SOL's argument regarding it is the statute doesn't allow for a tolling of the expiration of the order while you've got that capias issued and you are or are not finding this patient. And so just taking this case as an example, the order was set to expire within a couple of weeks of the time that we held that extension hearing in February of 2017. And the fact of the matter is that we could have issued a capias. I'm being tangential, Justice, and I apologize, but I want to say one other thing about the difference between a capias and a pickup order.
Okay.
What the statute allows us to do when a person is committed and being treated on an outpatient basis, and they violate their outpatient treatment conditions, it allows us to issue a pickup order to go out into the community and try to find that person at a fixed location. That is not a warrant. That's not a capias. It's not an all-points bulletin to law enforcement, right? And I recognize that in this case, that pickup order, which was done, the department, our Human Services Department, did make efforts. And you'll note that from the transcript in the case that they did attempt to go out and pick up this subject. And page 4 or 5 of the transcript indicates they did attempt to revoke outpatient status, And the Sheriff's Department, our Waukesha County Sheriff's Department, even tried to work with Milwaukee County and locate this person in Milwaukee County. One more tangent. I'm coming right back. Here's the other tangential thing. We don't have the ability to say to a person, even under commitment status, you cannot move to another county. We don't have the ability to limit their liberty in that way. And so once they're outpatient, if they make that choice, because I recognize that opposing counsel said, you know, we let her move to Milwaukee County. It wasn't Waukesha County's choice. It was her choice. And she gets to make that choice, right? And so she moved, when she left our facility in September of 2016, we knew she was going to a hotel in Milwaukee because she said, that's where I'm going to go stay. It's not a place of fixed habitation. It's not a permanent residence. She didn't establish residency in Milwaukee County, but that's where she went, right? And we knew that because she told our inpatient treatment staff that that's where she was going. So now she's in Milwaukee County.
Pursuant to a conditional transfer.
Correct. Pursuant to the
so
conditional transfer.
So you could have revoked the conditional transfer too, right?
I'm sorry?
Could you have revoked the conditional transfer?
That's what we attempted to do when the pickup order was entered. Now, the reason that pickup order is not in the record is because it doesn't reach the record until she's actually picked up. And then the documents are filed with the court, and then it becomes part of the court record. But that never happened because we never actually were able to pick her up. But the problem with the statute, as I was saying, is that there's no tolling of the expiration of that order of commitment. And so if what you do is follow the statute, it would create what is an absurd result. And the absurd result is we have a person who's dangerous, who's not receiving treatment, and we know that because she's not appearing for the treatment. We ask to revoke the conditional transfer. We issue the order to have her picked up. In the interim, we have a hearing. We don't find her. The court says, okay, I'm going to use what the statute currently provides. I'm going to say that we're going to issue a capias, toll the expiration for the next issue a capias and hold the hearing within 7 days of her detention. But there's nothing that tolls that expiration. And once that happens, we're right back to having to have new dangerous.
Well, except that you say we have a person who's dangerous. You had a person who was dangerous at the time of the petition, which was 6 months ago. They may or may not still be dangerous. I mean, you're operating as if this is a fixed world, and you know as well as I do it's always changing.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't the county have to start again? I mean, isn't the difference here, I'm trying to put my head on what's bothering at least me, isn't the difference here that we're talking about the state bringing something against someone? This isn't like a default judgment where you have two parties, they're in court, one person suing the other, someone doesn't show up, you issue a default, they get their judgment. This is the state acting to protect someone.
Right. And so, I'm sorry.
I mean, shouldn't that, and you're just going to default them when they don't show up, shouldn't that be a different situation than just defaulting a petition, someone in a court on a regular civil action?
Right. Whether the court decides that default judgment is generally appropriate and was specifically appropriate in this case, from my perspective, that's important. But from my perspective, what's more important is that the court address the problem with the statute. Because the problem with the statute is whether default judgment were used or whether some other mechanism or was not used or some other mechanism was used, the problem with the statute is we have no way to continue. And to your point, Justice Stout, the fact of the matter is, do we know that she's dangerous right now? We don't. But here's what we do know. We know that she was dangerous and 6 months, whether you think your perception of how long that is, from my experience doing this work, if the person is not receiving treatment, where are they? They're right back there, at least potentially. They're right back in that spot.
And then you have an argument for a brand new order.
Except they have to commit new dangerousness.
Well, what does new mean, though? That's not so clear. It doesn't have to be within the last week or two.
Right. So, but it's not going back to that incident. I can't relitigate that one. And so here's this example is of a person, because dangerousness is a continuum, okay?
You're going to talk about, I would just want to see if I can help at all or maybe just offer my experience on dealing with these matters. You often get someone who's brought in because they were initially arrested for some sort of behavior or something. It could be a different reason, or it could be a several party petition or something that brings them to the court's attention. That happened here back on August 10 of 16, where that was the emergency detention. And then they come in, and the people who need this kind of help and treatment aren't generally at the peak of their game at that point in time. And so the logic is you bring them in, you help them, you try to get them some treatment, you have a hearing, and then you determine what is the least restrictive place this person can be treated and helped to get back on their feet, right?
Yes.
So if you're doing your job right, and if this person is receiving good treatment, in theory, they should become progressively better and better and better, right?
Yes.
So under that logic, the initial order here that was entered at the end of August would be set for commitment sometime February-ish, and the county decided to extend that commitment or try to keep the help coming to this person. In the meantime, this person had been transferred to Milwaukee pursuant to a conditional transfer, right?
Well, she had moved to Milwaukee. The conditional transfer simply noted where she was, she had gone.
But the conditional transfer allowed that, and it could be revoked. Right.
And what I would say, and I want to be clear, she had traveled to Milwaukee. I do not believe she had established residency there, and I think that's important. But the fact of the matter is the conditional transfer, the attempt to revoke that was made.
But the point is you don't just deal with these people sometimes. Sometimes it's 6 months and things are pretty good. Other times it's 6 months and they're doing considerably better, but they still need the kind of assistance and help from the county to stay on track or really get on track, even though they don't evidence that initial dangerousness.
The thing that we know, Justice Ziegler, is this. She wasn't receiving the treatment that the court had mandated because she stopped coming for it. Right after November 2nd, she was no longer receiving that treatment, and that was the reason the attempt to revoke that conditional transfer and pick her up was made.
So you on your own can attempt to pick her up without necessarily having court intervention,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then is that different from a detention order?
Yes.
The pickup order?
Yes.
So what is a detention order compared to a pickup order?
By detention order, are you talking about the initial detention of a patient? Or are you talking about, I guess I'm not
okay.
Understanding your question.
Not the initial emergency detention, but are there any other means by which a person being treated can be picked up? Without court intervention?
No.
Okay.
To answer, no.
So then if you wanted to recommit her or extend the commitment and didn't want to wait until she was back in the position initially that she was found in, you don't have to show dangerousness because the theory is they're on this continuum of getting better if you're doing the job right.
Correct, or at least being maintained at a level that they're not dangerous. And what we're trying to avoid is having to have a person. So let's say, for the sake of argument, what we did was every time that we got in a situation where we couldn't provide, and I concede, she did not receive notice. The fact of the matter is Waukesha County did everything we could to provide notice. We sent it to her last known address, and we provided it to her counsel, which is what the notice statute requires. And so we followed the statute. Did we reasonably suspect that she wasn't going to get that notice where she was? We did, but we had no other recourse.
But these statutes contemplate the notion that someone will become progressively better throughout this continuum of treatment, and that dangerousness might not exist if they're getting that kind of treatment. But yet the commitment should continue, right?
Right, because what we're trying to do, and the reason, I mean, the extension standard for dangerousness came along a lot later than everything else. And the reason that was done was to try to prevent situations where people who aren't availing themselves of treatment and don't have recognition to their illness and need for treatment, we didn't want to be in a position where we had to go back and have them commit new dangerousness. And what I wanted to say about that is, this was a dangerous act that this woman engaged in. Was it the most dangerous thing I've ever seen? I've done this 16 years. It wasn't. wasn't the most dangerous thing I've ever seen. It was not good. But had she done something even more, even further down the continuum of dangerous, right? That happens all the time. And when we have people like that who are resistant to treatment, and again, I'm not blaming them because this we're not in the blame business. We're in the treatment business, right? And so they're resistant to treatment. They've committed they've done some very dangerous thing in the recent past. Should we then dismiss that case because we know we couldn't provide notice to them because they didn't follow their conditions of treatment? Again, not blaming them. But we weren't able to locate where they were because they essentially eloped from treatment.
Counsel,
it just doesn't make any sense. I'm sorry.
One of the ways that you want to treat that, what doesn't make any sense, I guess, in your mind, is having the court kind of read in a tolling statute. Is that what I understand?
Correct.
And without the tolling statute, you said there's a problem. Tell me what that problem is.
Okay. Thank you. So the statute allows, and just following through our fact pattern, we've got a person that has essentially dropped out of treatment and we can't locate them. The county and my office decides we need to continue this person in treatment because we need to try to get them back compliant with treatment and keep them from, again, becoming dangerous. So we then file a petition for extension of commitment.
Mm-hmm.
In the best way we can, we provide that notice to the patient and we provide that notice to their attorney. They don't appear for the hearing.
Yep. Okay.
The hearing occurs on February. The hearing is set for February 2nd, and their commitment's going to expire on February 10th.
Right.
If we don't do something, if what we do is what the statute says, which is issue a capias, and we'll, as soon as that patient is picked up, we will hold the hearing within 7 days of their detention. If they're not picked up until February 11th, we're done.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear from you. And that's the final consequence.
Correct.
That is, you lose all, from even your argument, you lose all jurisdiction after the end of the six-month period. You're
correct.
Done.
Correct.
Even though you've issued a capias, you're done.
Yes.
D-U-N-E. Isn't that right, Susan? Okay. So that's what you want us to write in. You need, under the current statutory scheme, you need something more. Otherwise, you're not going to have, from your perspective, this ability for year after year to file a petition for recommitment, even though you haven't picked up anyone. I mean, that problem doesn't exist under the current statutes, you're saying, in reality, because after 6 months, the end.
Right. And I think
I want to move on.
Yeah, sure. Sorry.
From the statute to the Constitution. And this lovely Constitution has been kind of left by the wayside. There is, under our law, notice requirements. I think not only for a default judgment, but also isn't there notice requirement for the court exercising personal jurisdiction?
There is.
And that comes under both statute and the Constitution. Now, we've talked a lot about the statute, and I guess both of you have pointed to different provisions in the statute as to where there is notice, the statutory requirement, and what or what may not comply with the requirement. I want to go to the constitutional requirement. The constitutional requirement for the exercise of personal jurisdiction is reasonable notice. Is that correct?
Yes.
And how was reasonable notice exercised vis-a-vis this petition for recommitment and this hearing?
Well, Justice Bradley, what I would say is that reasonable efforts were made to provide notice, and given the circumstances and the facts as we had them, that was the best we could do.
I understand that, and I really hear you being sympathetic. I mean, you resonate very well, but the law doesn't require for the exercise of personal jurisdiction under the Constitution, does it? In this context, deprivation of liberty by the state. We tried, and we really tried hard. It doesn't contemplate reasonable efforts of notice. It contemplates, for constitutional purposes, reasonable notice.
Right. I agree, but I would go back to the argument that I made initially, which is that personal jurisdiction was never lost. And because it was never lost, it did not have to be reacquired.
I want to be sure I understand your tolling, because we're talking all around it a little bit. What you want tolled is the expiration of the first commitment until she is brought back in on CAPIUS and you have that hearing within 7 days. Is that the item you want tolled?
Yes, and it's whatever order of commitment current in this fact pattern, it's the initial commitment, because that's what she was under at the
right.
time of the hearing. But it could be, to Justice Ziegler's point, it could be the second extension of commitment order. It's whatever commitment order is in place at the time that the CAPIUS and the order to hold the hearing within 7 days is issued.
Are we the appropriate body to fix a statute, even if we all agree, yeah, there's a real problem here? Are we the appropriate body to read a tolling provision in when the legislature didn't provide one?
I mean, my response would be that you're the body I'm before. I'm asking the court to address an issue because I see that issue, and believe me when I say that I've made that, I've gone to try to address that legislatively as well. I mean, this has been an issue that's been a problem forever, and what the courts have done is the courts have used different either case law or provisions to address it. It's not as though it's never been told by judicial order.
Another question for you. You appear to concede in response to the other Justice Bradley's questioning that there is a constitutional right to actual notice in proceedings that involve a deprivation of liberty, but I'm looking at another chapter that I have some familiarity with, Chapter 48. Courts regularly, at least in Milwaukee County, terminate parental rights when there has been absolutely no actual notice to parents because the statute provides for a litany of attempts that must be made, but there are many situations where people, like here, cannot be found, so that the Constitution can't always be implicated or violated just because somebody hasn't received notice of a civil proceeding. Right?
That's correct, and I didn't want to be heard to say that I thought that actual notice had to occur or the petition fails. That's not my position. My position is that the attempts to provide notice have to be made, and I want the court to recognize that the reason, again, not in the blame business, but the reason that notice was not provided here is because the patient who had the obligation to let us know when she was going to change her address did not. Justice Kelly, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. So you said you complied with the notice statute. Are you referring to 5120 or 80114?
80114.
Okay. With respect to the default in this case, which subsection of the default judgment statute would you say this qualifies under, 80602?
Well, my argument would be that it qualifies under 80605, which indicates that it may be entered against a subject who's appeared in an action but fails to appear at trial. And the default judgment standard also, or statute, talks about the – I apologize. My time is up. Can I complete my answer?
You can finish the answer.
Thank you. It also talks about the fact that the requirement of a summons, but again, in this case, there was no summons required because this wasn't the initiation of an action, but rather the continuation of it. I very much appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to begin by talking about this tolling rule, the proposed tolling rule by opposing counsel. He appears to be proposing it in order to deal with a person who has engaged in misconduct during the course of a commitment. We don't know whether SLL has engaged in misconduct. She may be dead. We don't know where she is. So his reasons for having the tolling rule may not even apply in this situation. That's the first point I want to make, is that we have to be very clear about this record. She disappeared. She could have been abducted. She could have been hit by a car and maybe in a coma in a hospital. Who knows where she is? It's everything I heard listening to opposing counsel was all about how to deal with misconduct.
Well, I didn't hear the word misconduct said once.
He didn't say the word misconduct. It's how he talked about it. This person, we have to pick her up. You know, she evaded service. She didn't keep us, not evaded service, she didn't keep us updated. She told us she was going over here. Those are forms of misconduct. The other problem with the tolling rule is I, again, would ask the very practical question, as with the default judgment potential rule, what purpose does this serve? If we don't know where this person is, you can toll the original commitment for 100 years. If she's in Waukesha and she's not behaving dangerously, they can't pick her up and commit her. If they found her and she wasn't behaving dangerously, they'd have to let her go. There always has to be a hearing. If she is both mentally ill and dangerous, but she's in Hawaii, they still can't pick her up and institutionalize her. And at any point, if you have an extended original commitment, if you issue an unending pickup order, there always has to be a hearing, always.
Counsel,
when you're moving from a...
Counsel, this sounds like matters of prudence rather than authority, right? I mean, it might not be prudent for Waukesha County to continue seeking these recommitment orders, but we're not here to judge the prudence of their decisions, right? We're here to decide whether they can do it.
Waukesha County, under the statute, cannot seek a recommitment of someone unless it has probable cause to believe that the person satisfies the standards for the recommitment statute.
Right. So that's,
it has no fresh evidence at this point, other than she left.
Yeah. So you've got a potential sufficiency of the evidence question, right? But that doesn't go to whether they can seek it, and it doesn't go to the question of whether they had jurisdiction beyond the 6 months.
Your Honor, at the end of 6 months of the original commitment, the circuit court loses competence to act.
Right, right. But in this case, the circuit court extended the commitment for a year. So the question was, did the court have the personal jurisdiction over SLL to do that, right? And if they did, then it becomes a question of prudence of whether this was a smart thing for Waukesha County to do. Yeah.
Well, obviously, I disagree that there was personal jurisdiction for all the reasons that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, for example,
right.
The Constitution isn't behind that. Mullane, Lessard, thus
yeah.
and such.
And I wouldn't ask you to concede if there was no jurisdiction. But if there's, for sake of argument, if there was jurisdiction, then it's just a question of prudence. Right? Isn't that what you're talking about? Waukesha County, why do you want to do this? You can't find her, so you can't treat her, and so there's no point for this. But that doesn't go to the question of whether they can do it. It's a question of whether they ought to do it.
Well, I need clarification on what it is we're saying they can do. Can they file a petition for recommitment?
Right.
Is that the question? If they have probable cause for the three elements, yes, and if they don't, then no, they can't, because then you're not complying with your obligations as a lawyer. You're filing an action that you have no business that's frivolous,
right,
or something like
that. So as of February 28th, the date of the hearing for the recommitment or the extension, Waukesha County might have been thinking, well, I don't know where she is right now, but we're going to find her. And when we find her, we're going to treat her, because that's what she needs, right?
I disagree. At that point, I don't believe that they had the fresh evidence to make the allegations to satisfy, to fresh probable cause, I would say, in order to satisfy a petition for recommitment. I don't think they should have. Or if they did, let's put it this way. Once they file a petition for recommitment, the court has an obligation to review that petition. And in this instance, it should have dismissed it. Nobody knew where she was, so they couldn't tell that there was essentially present dangerousness or, as we have in the recommitment context, if treatment were withdrawn, she was a proper subject for commitment. As a matter of fact, for all we know, she was thriving in Illinois under private care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, these cases are always very interesting. Thank you very much for fine briefs and very good argument from both counsel. We're going to take a brief recess now so that other students can come in and another set of attorneys can come and talk to us about our next case for the morning. We are adjourned.